Good evening, everybody. I am Josh Beiser, and welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. Tonight, we got a great cast for you. My guest is an old friend of mine who is currently a content designer for Pocket Gems. Please welcome to the cast, Craig Lewin.
It's a pleasure to be here, Josh. Thank you for having me on.
Yep, Craig, it's a pleasure to have you on. I know we haven't had a chance to talk in, at least like 3, maybe 4 years.
It's been a while, yeah, but it'll be good to catch up.
Definitely. So to get things going, I know we've been speaking on and off through email the last few months. Have you had any chance to like read Game Wisdom, just take a look at it for your own interests?
A little bit. I recently listened a bit to your Planetary Annihilation podcast. I was enjoying that today as I was going over some stuff. But no, your articles are pretty solid. It's a neat website. I'm really wishing you the best of luck with it.
Thanks. I know we've been doing our best to keep building it up over the last, we've gone over 2 years this past October. So it's definitely been a very strange trip, but fun. And it's just really great to have these podcasts and have a chance to sit down with developers and enthusiasts of the game industry. Let's get going with our cast. So to start things off, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you've been doing with the game industry?
Sure. So, a lifetime ago, I was actually a high school English teacher. I did that for a while and decided I'd rather make video games. Mm-hmm. So, I've been in the industry for, I want to say, about 4 years. I started out as a QA tester at a company that made Facebook games. I did that for a while. And since then, I've moved on to my current company, Pocket Gems, where I actually made the transition from QA to design, where I am currently a content designer for them.
Interesting. And for people who haven't heard of Pocket Gems, what types of games do they like to make?
So Pocket Gems is a mobile developer. We make smartphone games, largely casual titles. But we have just recently put out our new game called War Dragons, which is much closer to mid-core, hardcore gameplay. It's honestly pretty cool. It's you've got a base, you defend it. It's like tower defense, and also you blow crap up with your dragons. It's honestly pretty fun. It just came out. It's a big old 3D game. You should give it a shot, actually.
Cool. I know a few months ago I spoke with Seth Sivak from Proletariat. He used to work at Zynga Boston. And it's almost interesting how his past sort of is the same as yours. He first started with Facebook, obviously, with Zynga. He did Indiana Jones Adventure World before that whole thing just collapsed in on itself. Now he's making mobile games. His first game, World Zombination, just came out a few months ago. I know they're planning on porting that to Steam, I think, in the near future. Are there any plans for you and your team at Pocket Gems to start looking at the Steam or digital distribution route?
I can't say that I've been in any meetings where somebody has said something to the likes of Steam.
Okay.
We are moving, at least with War Dragons, we're moving in a slightly different direction than we've historically done. Mm-hmm. Like I said, most of our games previous to this have been casual games. Actually, the one that I'm working on is a hidden object game. It's called Secret Passages. That's the one that I currently do the writing for. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of story design, narrative design, dialogue writing, story planning, that kind of thing. And that's overlaid on top of, like I said, a hidden object game. So there's that, and we have one called Tap Campus Life, where you know, create a sorority and that kind of thing. So it's a bit of a departure for us to go to fire-breathing dragons. It does seem, at least from my experience, I'm a hardcore gamer, at least in terms of demographic. It's funny how when you start actually making games, you have less time to play them. So
yeah, especially, and for me, it's when you start writing about them, you realize just how little time
it
actually
just,
is.
It might just be like a growing up thing. I don't know. I've never done it before, so it's my first time.
Yeah, mine too.
But as for digital distribution, to not wander too far off, I can't say we've ever decided to do that. It would be a completely new market for us, so not necessarily. But with an expansion out into more mid and hardcore games, who knows what the future holds.
Yeah. Now, I do find it curious, as you said, that Pocket Gems first started, in terms of your core audience, being more the casual, casual and social game market. And now with War Dragon, is sort of like your attempt at getting to, or starting to reach the mid and hardcore gamers. And I'm just wondering, War Dragons, how long has it been since it came out?
A number of days. It was, I believe it was earlier this week, actually.
Okay. And for those of you listening, in terms of when this podcast is recorded, this is almost the end of April, so War Dragon should probably be out for at least a good month or so, hopefully by the time this podcast goes up. And one thing that I'm really curious about, and if you can find this out, you know, after this cast, I'll be interested in knowing just how well the game is doing among your audience. Because one of the things that we've been talking about and seeing is how much trouble it is creating unique original IPs for the mobile and casual space. Because of how much the market has been basically grown on very casual, very simplistic monetized games. And there's a lot of developers, including one of my previous guests, Thorsten Rauser, who is very concerned about the state of the mobile market.
Well, okay, so a couple of things that come to mind for that. Mm-hmm. For Thorsten Rauser's stuff, from what I understand, and of course I may be misunderstanding his points, he seems to be tackling the idea of the mobile market as like a gambling thing or an abusive thing, and in a lot of cases, that can be true. I think that we've seen a move away from it as the audience for mobile games has sort of matured and become a little more wise to some of the stuff that developers could get away with early on. I mean, it's the whipping boy of everybody at this point, but if you mention a game like Farmville or something, with no disrespect meant, of course, but the idea being that, okay, here's your casual game, here's your very straightforward mechanics in terms of how that works. Okay, that worked. Everybody copy that from there on. And I'm not strictly saying that that's an exploitative game, but yeah, those elements do exist in terms of like, okay, well, here's enough fun for you to have for now, and here's the stick instead of the carrot. I don't think that's going anywhere. I think that as long as the market supports it, it's going to stick around because it's profitable.
Yeah.
There is, at least in as far as I've observed, this is my personal observation, that mobile games strike me as leaning much more toward the business end of the industry than AAA or especially PC games. In that, yes, a game is being made and a game is being developed, and there's a ton of talent that goes into it, art, design, all of these things, code. But at least as far as I've seen with mobile games, it seems like it goes a lot more toward like, okay, end of the day, did we make money today? And obviously everybody who makes a game wants to be able to afford rent and a roof over their head and food on their table and all these things. But I believe there's a continuum, and it goes on one end from a pure business perspective to on the other end a pure art perspective, where victory is measured by whether you made a boatload of money or whether you successfully made an artistic statement. I would like to make good art and also pay rent, and that's kind of what I strive for, at least in what I do at Pocket Gems. And I'm trying to remember because I had two other really sharp points and they've flown my memory. It's late. I'm sorry.
don't worry. You're not the only one who's had that happen. It's turned into a little game sometimes on these podcasts with how long it takes for me to just completely forget a point. And then I spend like 20, 30 seconds going, okay, wait, what was it? Now, of course, I smartly edit those parts out. So most people don't hear that. But yeah,
just a lightning wit as far as your listeners are concerned.
Exactly. Everything is sharp, on the point, no grammatical problems at all. I'm just, you know, the ultimate speaker.
Well, that is your prerogative to do so. But no, you mentioned Thorsten and his stuff. What was the thing you said just before that, though?
I believe I was talking about, in terms of the casual market, in terms of trying to create an original or core hardcore game for the mobile and social game demographics.
So, okay, those were the other two things I wanted to think about. I wanted to talk to you about originality, and I wanted to talk to you about Shadows of Mordor. So in terms of originality, there's creating sort of a new idea from whole cloth. which, as someone who has to come up with creative stuff all the time, is kind of overrated. Not to say that it's a bad idea to create stuff from whole cloth. You absolutely should. But it's hard as hell to do that in a great way that comes out successful every time. You're going to have a lot of really awful ideas over and over again, which is why you should create as much as you possibly can to get all the crappy stuff out of the way ahead of time. But the idea of the mobile market being devoted to completely original ideas is a difficult one for me to swallow. Because that's not really how any creative endeavor works in any meaningful way. So another example in terms of a like talking about originality or completely original ideas for games where that might not be as applicable is Shadows of Mordor. A lot's been said about it. It's a wonderful game. But it doesn't really do anything tremendously new. What it does is it takes existing stuff and it just does something cool with it. People say, oh, it looks a lot like Assassin's Creed. Oh, it has a lot of fighting like Arkham Horror. And that's okay. I mean, if the end of the, if at the end of the day you're trying to produce a trying to produce a fun experience, it's okay if you didn't invent it from whole cloth. I mean, I'm not talking about in terms of like copyright or attribution or anything like that. I'm talking I'm talking like marketplace of ideas stuff. So I don't want to go to the I don't want to castigate Thorsten Rauser. I mean, I've never met the guy. But it just, it's frustrating for me to hear the idea that, oh, you know, if it's not original, if it's not new, then you're not creating cool stuff.
It's not so much about that, and I'll talk, I think I'll go in a little more detail about what both him and I sort of agree with as one of the issues we see with the mobile market after you're finished with your example with Shadows of Mordor.
Oh, no, that was pretty much it. It was the idea that while the components reminded people of existing stuff, it was put together in a way that was interesting and compelling and and fun to play.
Okay. And before I talk about my point, I want to go back to what you said a few moments ago regarding art versus business, because that's a very important topic and one that I like to talk about whenever we can, because I think that's a very big issue for especially students and enthusiasts looking at the industry. Because as you said, Craig, there's a lot of people who approach the game industry purely on the art standpoint. They want to make completely original, unique ideas. They don't care the game sells 1 cent. They just, you know, want to create. And that's great, but then as you perfectly said, how are you going to pay your rent on that? You can't pay your rent with good ideas.
I mean, well, the ideal world is where you create something so brilliant that everybody recognizes it, buys it, and
you can retire to a small island somewhere in the South Pacific.
Yeah, I mean, the example I'm thinking of is Jonathan Blow, but I think even he has an interview where he said something to the effect of, like, I made a thing, and I released it, and then the next morning, my bank account had 6 digits in it, and money is a fake idea. Like, none of this is, this doesn't mean anything. Like, what the hell happened? This is ridiculous.
Yeah. And I think that's a really good point, and I do think that the best game developers, or the ones who can make a living off of this, are the ones who can balance both the business and the artistic side of the industry. It's a topic that I've talked about so many times with previous guests about the importance of actually running a game studio. Understand what you can and can't do, handling the PR, understanding sales and pricing. These are all elements that are more on the business side that I bet a lot of people either just gloss over or don't care about because they're more interested in the creative angle. But you still need to balance your creative side with the side of you that's trying to make a product or something that will sell and hopefully earn you some money.
It's something that I agree. It's something that I struggle with a lot when I'm doing my the work that I currently do at Pocket Gems. We have an established audience, and it's super important for me to remember that I am not my game's audience. If I make a game or if I write for a game in a way that it will make me happy, that's only going to make me happy and the people who are just like me. One of the most important skills that I've had to learn, and I absolutely did not have this when I first came to the position that I currently have, was being able to say, okay, how do I make a good game that is not for me to play?
Yes.
So it's part of it. And if you're in a position where you're starting to run a studio, not that I have ever run my own studio, but I would imagine that if you're in a position where you're like, I want to start my own game studio, I want to do my own development, awesome. If you cannot put yourself in a position where you can say, who besides me would enjoy my game, hire somebody who can, and everyone will be happier.
Yes, that is an amazing point. It's not just with the mobile market, but I've spoken with professional developers who own their own studios who also have to ask that question with every game idea they come up with.
So, caveat though, unless you're like running with scissors, mm-hmm. and in which case you can make exactly the kind of game that you want and you'll be happy because only people like you will buy it, and congratulations, you have achieved your goal. You win.
I guess I assume you're talking about their recent expansion to Postal 2 after like, what is it, like 10 years? 14 years since?
I believe it was something like 12 years, an expansion in Glorious Unreal Engine, I want to say 1.5.
Nice.
So I'm going to disconnect my phone and lock my door and make sure nobody sees me playing it and enjoy the hell out of it.
That's almost as good as Duke Nukem Forever. What was that, like 10 years, I think?
Nukem Forever was, I believe, 14 years from announcement to eventual release.
Yeah. And I'm one of the few guys who played it too, so yay me.
I'm sorry.
I know. I thank you for your condolences.
I hope you recover. Yeah. I apologize.
All right. Getting this back to talking about the developers, you said with being able to sort of put yourself in the shoes of your audience or your demographic, another part of that is specific to game design is really being able to design a game that can be enjoyed by other people. It's a challenge that we see very much in the strategy and 4X genre with games like Europa Universalis, Galactic Civilizations, and even simpler games like Sid Meier's Civilization, that series. And being able to create a game that is complicated, that is for your audience, but at the same time, you need to make it so that it can appeal to more people. And again, this goes back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago with profit versus art. To make a game that is accessible, you do need to make those condolences or make those accessibility options for new people, or you're never going to grow an audience.
It's the entire process of making the games, and this is speaking from experience at this point, but the process of making a game, at least in the mobile market, is a constant negotiation. It's the idea, not just like, oh, are we going to make art or business today? It's mm-hmm. not like, how much money do we want to make? It's like, all right, how do we negotiate the shifting territory of like, all right, how far are we going to go with this? Is this the spot where we want to put an absolute ton of work into narrative, mm-hmm. or is this where we're like, hey, we need to make sure the mechanic here is solid, that we are messaging the things we need to message to our user, or is here where we double down on story? And in the end of it, you need to make sure that you're attending to all these things.
Mm-hmm.
But the sort of conversation of like, all right, how far are we going to go today? What are we working on today in terms of like, what does the game need at this point? That's mm-hmm. Based on the development experience that I've had so far, that is, it's a daily conversation and one that you need to have, one that yeah. you absolutely should be having. If you ever find yourself that if everybody in the room is agreeing on the same thing, then you need to throw it out and start over.
Yeah. All right. I know we sort of got a little bit off track regarding mobile and casual game development, but I do want to go back to the point that I was going to bring up about where Thorsten and I were sort of in agreement on our thoughts on the mobile game platform.
I'm ready to have a fight with you. Let's do this.
Okay. Let's do it. All right. The part where we're both very much disillusioned or annoyed with mobile and casual game development are when developers specifically turn to gambling or monetization tactics in order to effectively squeeze as much money out of a game as possible by, I guess, quote-unquote, tricking the consumer base. And what we're talking about are mechanics like pay-or-wait mechanics, energy, anything that's designed to elicit the player or try to convince them that they need to spend money in order to keep enjoying this game, when it's not really growing the game in a sense. We see this in a lot of very simplistic casual games. The one that I was hooked on for a little bit was like Marvel Puzzle Quest. We can see this in games of like Farmville, any of those Ville-type games, where the more you play, the more the game basically is trying to get you spend more money, whether it's by buying more energy, buying more specific content. And the games that are having stuff like $50 to $100 items that they want you to try and buy, or I think the best way to sum all that up are games that specifically are designed to target the whales, or the 0.0010% of people who are going to spend, you know, $500-$600 on these games because they become completely hooked in it. And the mobile developers who know that and effectively try to target those that audience as opposed to developing a compelling game. And as you said a few minutes ago, the dream idea of creating a game that's so good that people want to play it. This would be the complete antithesis of that.
Well, people are still, so I'm going to sound like I'm the devil here, but people are still playing those games. And I guess part of the question is, are they doing it because it's fun or are they doing it because of some sort of psychological exploitation? Anything that tricks you into having fun through some like Psych 101 conditioning, it feels a little shady, sometimes a little more than a little shady. But I mean, if you're talking about monetization, free-to-play is not bereft of value. I think that the free-to-play model can be very frustrating in some cases. I think a lot of those cases, especially with a more educated market now, arise when the user is expecting one thing and instead gets like they're expecting a more traditional model and instead they get the free-to-play model. But when everybody walks in knowing that, hey, this is a free-to-play game, here's what you should expect, and then the company delivers on those models, or the developers deliver on that model rather, I think that there might be less cognitive dissonance about what we were expecting versus what we get. So the $100 items, it's hard for me to speak on a $100 in-app purchase. The most common purchases in the games that I work on are nowhere near that level. While we have those in our games, I can't speak to specific numbers, but that's not the most popular thing that's purchased. And in terms of my personal monetization on games, my model is less, oh, I want to play more, but it's more, oh, I want to reward the developers for what they have done. They've created a nice product. I want to say, all right, here's some money. I get something out of it. But honestly, at this point, I've played enough that I feel that you've earned it. And an example for that for me was, this was a while back, but I was playing Warframe pretty heavily. This was many months ago. But I enjoyed the hell out of the game. It was a free-to-play game. You're a space ninja, what's not to like? And after playing about 60 hours of, you know, chopping up vat-grown cyborgs, I was like, all right, this is pretty cool. Had I known this is the experience that I would have had, I would have dropped a bunch of money on it. And I actually ended up spending something like $100 on that game over the course of the 60 hours that I was playing it. But I didn't do it like advancing timers. I didn't do it buying currency that I could have earned otherwise. I did it almost all at once at the end because I was like, all right, cool. You've earned my patronage at this point. That feels like it might be a cleaner model. I mean, rhetorically, I guess.
Oh, go ahead. Finish your thought.
No, no, no. If the presentation, if the idea that, you know, you lure in, if the idea is that the developer lures in the user and then pulls the bait and switch and says, oh, time for you to pay if you want to have any more fun, that might feel a little shiesty. But if the model is the game's free, you can pay to not necessarily progress any further in a way that you otherwise would not have been able to do, but to that you know exactly what you're getting. That feels a bit more transactional rather than, is that the word I really mean actually? Oh, sorry, that feels more like a patron relationship than a purely transactional relationship. That's what I mean.
Yeah, and that's a good point. That's one that we talked about in the past between what are considered like the best examples of free-to-play versus the ones that do try to either trick or get the money out of their player base through these monetization tactics. And probably the go-to example that we always go back to would be League of Legends as one of the best examples of the free-to-play. Now, speaking about League of Legends is a little, I guess there is the caveat that the developers really are, they're not so much interested in it from a profit standpoint. I believe there's been reports saying like for like the first few months or a year of the game, they were barely making money. And it really took a while for them to get that, to get the profit base going. But That is an example of a game where, as you said, Craig, they lay it out, you know, exactly to the penny. You spend $5, you can get this. If you want to spend $20, you can get this, this, and this. There's no hidden fees. There's no, oh, you have to spend this money, but then there's only a 1 in 5 chance you'll get something.
I mean, it's not like you've ever – I've played a Little League, but mm-hmm. but the idea is that you've never been like in a game cooldown where, hey, you have to wait another hour if you want to play a game, but if you pitch us $2, you can cut that down to zero. Mm-hmm. And that would be the more abusive kind of stuff that I would say.
Yeah. And as talking about that, I just want to ask you, Craig, have you had any chance to look at some of the free-to-play or quote-unquote free-to-start offerings from Nintendo that they've been slowly unveiling?
I haven't, actually. Tell me a bit more about that.
Nintendo has been getting into free-to-play, or what they've been coining, free-to-start. And there's currently two games on the Nintendo 3DS store that involve that. One is Pokemon Shuffle, and Pokemon Rumble World. They're both very basic games. They both have premium currency in the form of diamonds. And both games try to hit you with a lot of the same monetization models that we've been talking about as more on the skeezy side of things. They have pay or wait timers. They have you can only play the game for a limited number of time per sitting before you're either kicked out or you have to give them money. Now, you do earn premium currency through play, but it's like you may earn 1 or 2 diamonds for like 2 hours of play. And the most basic thing costs like 5 diamonds, that type of deal. So you're earning these little diamonds, but it's never enough to really move you forward. And playing, for example, Pokemon Rumble World, what they do is they build the timers into every time you go on like a little quest or a mission, when you get back, there's a timer on that balloon that you use to travel. And mm-hmm. as you go up in level, all the timers basically get progressively longer. So when you first start playing, you have to wait like 5 seconds for the time before you start playing. Big deal, right? But then 5 hours in, when you're maybe rank 10, that same timer is now 30 minutes.
These are pretty standard methods of timer monetization in the industry. I guess the question that I have, and it's hard for me to straight out say like, hey, timers are skeezy no matter what you do. What would feel unpleasant to me just as a player, not even as a developer, is if I were playing a game and all of a sudden, surprise, there's an hour timer.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, and it's unskippable aside from like a vast sum. And in terms of mobile development, a vast sum would be like $5 or $10. Like that would be mm-hmm. ridiculous. That would feel purely abusive. And I'm really hoping that I'm not forgetting that if we ever do that in our games. I don't think we do that in our games. But mm-hmm. It's the transactional knowledge idea that mm-hmm. like, okay, if you start them off and right off the bat, the first thing that you show them is like, hey, when you do this thing, there is a timer. Now, in the first time, it might be like, hey, you got to wait 30 seconds or 5 seconds or whatever. That's like, okay, the player now knows that the timer is a mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, like, basically, if it boils down to you must pay to advance,
mm-hmm.
that ends up feeling like it could be potentially abusive. But if it is, and I mean truly possible, to play in a meaningful way without being forced to pay beyond what you've been told you'd have to pay,
mm-hmm.
in the case of a free game, if it's free to play, it really does have to be free to play and not like, okay, you can log in and watch how terrible you are.
Mm. Yeah, and
that's where I feel like it sort of potentially strays into the realm of dishonesty mm-hmm. because you're spending your time playing the game. The player should have a very solid idea of, okay, here is how my time is valued when I play this game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And talking about those types of hidden purchases or when it becomes abusive, like later in the game, that's something that we see when developers try to go the pay to win option. When they specifically design content in a free-to-play game that is just all around better, and then saying, oh, you want to compete now? Here's, you know, spend $5 here. But then, oh, we'll release something new in a month or 2 months down the line, and it just becomes almost like an arms race of having to keep giving money. But as you said, Craig, the best or the examples that work, or at least aren't as abusive or looked down upon, are the ones that do their best to spell every single detail out so that nothing is hidden, nothing is going to pop up one day and say, oh, you need to spend $100 or you can't progress or anything like that.
Yeah, essentially. The thing is, I'll be the first to admit that I essentially have some sort of weird honesty fetish, and that's how I would like to see games. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if these decisions are able to be made universally.
Yeah.
I mean, there could be some element that I'm not aware of or something that I simply don't understand where these things aren't appropriate. These decisions aren't appropriate. And it does make sense in the model to say, like, okay, no, that, like, pay to win is right. And that was not a game that I would personally play. Mm-hmm. But if the people making the decisions for your product, for your game, for your company, decide, hey, we're going to prioritize making an absolute unholy pile of money, then there are certain strategies you can do that are going to do that better than they're going to produce a game of artistic merit. And developers need to be honest with themselves when they decide, okay, what is our actual goal?
Mm-hmm.
And you get a lot of cognitive dissonance between developers and players when they say one thing and clearly do another thing. But you get another layer of cognitive dissonance when the decision makers in an organization say one thing, but the developers are doing another thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a conversation that needs to be had by the developers with themselves and by the developers with the players and that sort of thing. And some companies navigate it better. Riot is a good example of, like, mm-hmm. hey, here's what your money's going to get you. Everybody knows what's up, right? Yeah, mm-hmm. we know what's up. All right, cool. And
yeah.
No terrible example comes to mind, so I won't paint myself into a corner with that.
Okay. Now, speaking about monetization, not just in the mobile market, but just in the game industry in general, I do want to ask you, Craig, about your thoughts really on what we're seeing in terms of game devaluation. This is something that we've been seeing happen over like the last, I would say, maybe 5-6 years since.
I'm sorry, did you say game devaluation?
Yes.
Okay, go on. I'm not quite sure what you mean by that.
What I mean is basically the price that people are willing to spend to buy a game has steadily gone down. We're seeing this especially in the indie market, where before $20, $30 was considered the average. This is what you would expect to buy a game for. But today, people are now more inclined to buy games at the $5 to $10 price compared to then and spending $30+ on a single game. A lot of people, you know, look at that like, oh my God, why should I spend that much money on one game? Part of it has been because of just the immense amount of games that are coming out these days. I mean, you look on Steam and there's at least 10 to 15 new games coming out daily.
Their current library is, I mean, it's broken 2,500. I think it's pushing 3,000 at this point. If not more, I don't know. I could be out of date.
Yeah, I mean, I have like 1,000 games on Steam by now. I know that's like nowhere near enough what's on there. And the other problem is with so many sales that's going on, that it's conditioning people to wait for these sales as opposed to buy a game new. Why should someone spend $60 on a brand new game when 2 months they can get it for $20, $25? Now, there are obviously exceptions to that rule. Games like Call of Duty, anything from Nintendo, Blizzard, those types of games. But for the vast majority of specifically AA and indie developers, there's definitely this push and pull towards how much do I price my game to get enough money that I'm making enough to make a profit versus enough that I'm not going to piss off my fan base and they're going to be like, how dare you charge as much? You know, I'm never going to buy another game from you again. Or, of course, the ever popular, I'm just going to pirate your game and, you know, screw you. Now, taking this to the mobile market, one thing that we're seeing with so many games going the free-to-play in-app purchase route that there's a lot of difficulty with trying to sell premium content. The big example of this last year was Monument Valley, when they got into a huge trouble with their fan base when they released, I think it was like a $2 or $4 like mini expansion to their game. And it just, their whole fan base just erupted at them, you know, saying, how dare you try to charge this when your game was free? So, from your experience, Craig, with mobile development and working at Pocket Gems, what are you seeing in terms of like people being accepting of higher prices or buying premium content with the mobile development space? Well, I know I said a mouthful there. I'm going to take a drink while you're thinking about that.
Take all that in. All of the games that we make at Pocket Gems, are all free to play. They're all free to download. And it's a point of pride that you can play all of our games and meaningfully participate in advance in them without spending a dime.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason why we are like that is because I don't know anybody on our design teams really. I don't know any designer at our company who doesn't have, you know, a submarine commander's log worth of hours, you know, in front of a computer or in front of a console. Like, our inspiration comes from, you know, these classic games. And it's funny you mentioning like people flipping out over spending $30 on an indie title. I mean, I remember spending like $80 on an SNES cartridge. But
oh yeah, I'm up there with you there.
How times have changed.
Yes, we're old, basically.
Yeah, well, you got old. I'm fine. No. In terms of our content model is different. I mean, I don't want to like shut down the idea, but the content model is like, okay, the game is free. Most of the game is free. More stuff comes out regularly. There's still a bunch of free stuff in that pile of new stuff, but some of our content is premium. And we find that people are cool with it. I mean, it's not like we're constantly struggling to justify premium content. Whether that's the market being experienced enough to be like, all right, this is the model, this is how it goes, is one thing. But, I mean, I like to think that we demonstrate value in the premium content so that people say, you know, no, that's worthwhile. Like, I know what I'm going to get because I've got a history that I can look back on. The content bar stays at a certain level or goes up, ideally. And again, it's transactional knowledge. The Monument Valley thing was really interesting to me, and I'm not 100% sure what the hell caused that. I mean, I think it might come back to that same idea where, you know, the first one is, you know, the first game is free, it's wonderful, people love it, and that actually works against them, that they loved it so much that when the next offering costs money, the fact is not that it costs $2. That's irrelevant. The price, I mean, ultimately the price point isn't super relevant. It's the infinite increase from zero to any amount of money that they have to pay. The gut instinct is that it's entitlement, but it's probably more complicated than that, and I wouldn't want to write it off just to that simple interpretation. I almost want to say that it's a mark in their favor that they made a game so good that people were expecting, like, wow, this is something I want in my life, I want more of this, and they're shocked when there's any barrier between them and getting more of what they enjoy. So, you know, congratulations, you have this terrible problem to deal with, you've worked hard to earn it, good job.
Now, one thing I just want to clarify, both from my understanding and the audience listening, for the games at Pocket Gems, in terms of, as you said, that you release both free and premium content, in terms of the premium content, is it like new levels, new missions, stuff like that?
So we essentially do – the game that I work on, Secret Passages, we essentially do quests. Some of them can be participated in without spending any premium currency. Some of them do require the expenditure of a small amount of premium currency to unlock, at which point you can progress through it and you play the game normally. Some of them are limited time content so that you can, you know, unless you play perfectly, you have to spend a little bit of a currency to catch up. But again, if you play perfectly, which is not impossible, you can still participate in leaderboards and then so on and so forth. In terms of the quality of the content, it's important to message that all your content is super good. In an ideal world, it's all the same high quality bar, and what you have your users paying for is just more cool stuff. When I'm writing for it, it always feels bad to me when I'm like, oh, okay, well, I've only got so much time. I better put all like the super great stuff behind the paywall. And I avoid that as literally as much as I possibly can so that everything is worthwhile. And if somebody likes the free stuff, they're like, okay, so that's the taste. There's more if I want to buy in.
Okay. Now, another part of this, I just want to get your thoughts on, Craig, regarding a game basically subsisting off of continued development, continued monetization. Have you looked any at all at Payday 2 and Overkill Software's monetization model for the game?
I played it a while back when it came out. I have noticed that they have put out an absolute ton of DLC for it. A lot of it free, a lot of it not. And I haven't got back into it lately, although I've been looking at it. I've been thinking about getting back into it. The trouble is that I need a reliable crew to play it with. But
Right here. If you want to just send me a message.
Yeah, we'll catch up on that later.
Yeah.
But what was the point that you wanted to make about it? Was it the mix of free and premium content?
I want to talk about specifically how the game is basically not just living, but thriving off of monetization. The game has recently went over 2 years of being out. It was originally priced at $30, and the amount of DLC they've been putting out has been enough to basically, essentially keep the game in continued development for the next...
They just made an announcement about that. Yeah, about
it was like 12 or 24 more months of content for that game. This was only supposed to be like a 6 to 12 month post-release support back two and a half years at this point. And the amount of monetization, what they've done by releasing these little DLC packs and pricing it properly is they've been able to take this game and essentially be able to continue earning profit from it while being able to work on it. So they don't need to release like new games and test the water with those ideas. They can continue to support Payday 2, and it's almost like at that same level of Team Fortress. Now, obviously, Team Fortress has Valve and Steam Superbucks, you know, supporting that. So it's not like they're hurting for money with Team Fortress. But the Payday 2 example is a game that a lot of people talk about. Critics do decry the amount of DLC and monetization, but at the same time, this would be an example of a game basically living off of itself thanks to its monetization.
Well, for the critics decrying DLC, I think that that's a different case in this part. Mm-hmm. I know that I want to say Sakurai just went on some big rant about DLC with regard to Smash Brothers. There's two models there. I think that in one hand, you've got DLC, which was ostensibly cut from the original game. And on the other, you've got continued content support for a game for stuff that like never existed in the first place. There's absolutely something to be said for a development team that has the time to continue working on a game for long after launch. Having people who are familiar with the game just leads you to better content. And moving on, as soon as you launched a game, to the very next thing. I mean, if you've got something cool coming up and you just really want to dive into it, then, you know, more power to you. If that's, you know, what you think is the best use of your time, and that's obviously the developer's choice to make. But if the whole story isn't told yet, or if there's more cool stuff to do with the game, I certainly don't think there's anything inherently wrong with DLC. I think it can be done poorly, just as with any other models. Yes. I mean, monetization can always be done poorly. But for a game like Payday 2, from what I've seen, just looking at the descriptions of the DLC that they've been putting out, there's new guns, new characters. I think they went from like 4 characters starting out to, what are they up to, like a dozen, 10, something like that? Most of which were free?
No. Two were free. Two I know were definitely free. Okay. And then so I think there's a total of 8 characters right now. And 3 of them are all DLC lock. You do need to spend $5 or $6. They come with their own guns, masks, right, stuff like that.
So still, there is a fundamental difference between like, oh, the grim specter of on-disc DLC. Like, well, we could have included it, but instead we decided to charge you. Versus stuff like... what was it? The guy with, I think it was Esposito, the actor who was in Breaking Bad, and now he's this whole new character, and now you've got this new game mode, the heist planning type stuff. That is, if it's a meaningful expansion, ultimately, I guess that's the continuum, where on one hand, you've got like, horse armor on disc DLC crap, and on the other hand, you've got a meaningful expansion of the core idea of the game. Whereas previously it was, let's do a bank raid, now it's, let's plan out this multi-stage adventure where we raid a bank and then move on to speedboats or whatever. Like, when the core idea is expanded on and it's closer to like the old like expansion pack style, I'm talking like Diablo 2, Baldur's Gate 2, like that kind of expansion pack, that's on the opposite end of, you know, the grim specter of terrible DLC.
Yeah. And I think another point, I think this is one that you brought up a few minutes ago, is the importance of properly educating the consumer base on what your intentions are going to be. If you just go dark and then come out one day with like, oh, we're going to give you 30 levels, but we're going to charge you $5. People may find that very distrustful because, hey, I bought your game for free. You know, where did this price come from? But if you educate them on and say, hey, we're going to develop completely original content for the next 2 months. It's going to be $2 a pop. If you're interested, great. If not, you still have this great base game to begin with. People are probably going to be a little bit more accepting of that.
Yeah, I would agree. And we usually refer to that kind of stuff as messaging. And it's important when you're down at as low a level as like the tutorial of your game. But I think that the core idea behind it applies even to your marketing and, mm-hmm. and your how you're communicating with your user base. Yeah. It's the expectations that are set both in how you talk about the game, how you talk about the game's monetization model. I mean, it comes down to the nitty-gritty of UI even, which elements are highlighted, which are backgrounded, and so on and so forth. But the conversation with your users is not limited to your forums.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. It is an important part, obviously, especially forum, community management, basically making sure that everyone's on the same page. We've seen so many examples of developers causing many controversies due to poor PR, the erratic Twitter posts. I mean, too many examples to list here. But yeah, very important point about that.
Now, yeah, it's pretty easy to get yourself in trouble. So mm-hmm. you generally try to be very straightforward and not mess around too much. At least that's my attitude toward it.
Yeah. Now, another major point about mobile game development that I really do want to bring up with you, Craig, and mm-hmm. this is something that we sort of talked about earlier in the cast regarding getting core and hardcore gamers interested in mobile games. One of the things that we've been seeing a lot is developers having trouble with appealing to that demographic, whether it's because they don't like the gameplay or they just completely tune out on the monetization model. So I'm just wondering, from your experience at Pocket Gems, what kind of discussions have you guys been having in terms of trying to create content that appeals to gamers like you and I, or to just like the general core marketplace?
I think that there are a couple layers of challenges in terms of getting the more core demographic interested in mobile games.
Mm-hmm.
First off, on one of the shallowest layers, I think that there's simply a stigma surrounding it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the kind of games that have been successful, which, and I mean like crazy Mondo successful,
mm-hmm.
And this is actually especially true in like the Chinese market, you look at them and there are gameplay elements that you would simply never see in a console or a PC game,
mm-hmm.
which is where the vast majority of the demographic we're discussing generally spends their time. And we're talking about stuff like slots mechanics and countdown timers and that kind of thing. But aside from that, we are seeing more of it now, but there's almost an issue of depth to be brought up. I mean, mm-hmm. you would be very hard-pressed, I think, to find a popular mobile game where it's got a level of story as deep as just off the top of my head, like a Final Fantasy game.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that they don't exist, but I would say that they're certainly a rarity in the market.
Mm-hmm.
One of the challenges that we faced is like, all right, what is it that core gamers genuinely enjoy? What is it that what is the element that could transfer?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not to say that there necessarily is one, but you know, we hope that there is. With War Dragons, a lot of it, and again, I wasn't on the War Dragons team when they were developing it, but having played it for a while now, one of the things that sticks out to me is the production value. That a lot of it is the developers showing that they are taking the presentation of their art, and when I say content, I mean like the meat of the game, not mm-hmm. like content with a capital C, like oh, we're going to put out content. That the art is taken, if not seriously, then with serious intent, that it's not just like, eh, whatever, throw a shell up there, whatever, do a crappy UI, we're going to get them in the doors and then we're going to fleece them. Like, mm-hmm. if it ever feels like the meat of the game is an afterthought, then I think that that's an immediate turnoff to a core gamer.
Mm-hmm.
That their experience, that their desires are being catered to is I mean, I'm a core gamer. When I feel like somebody spent a hell of a lot of time making sure that the play experience, the phenomenon of actually sitting down and experiencing this game was taken quite seriously, that feels like it's worth my time. Mm-hmm. Almost, and this is getting into abstract ivory tower crap, but almost like I'm being respected by the developer. Mm-hmm. That they're taking it as seriously as I would like to take it, almost like they're giving me permission to take it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And with many mobile games in the past, it seems like that was not the case. So I'm hoping that, you know, when the art of game creation is taken more seriously, that everyone is happier and that everyone has a better experience. Well, that's a separate point, but that's what I have to say on that.
Yeah. Now, that actually takes me to another point I want to ask you about, Craig. As we said earlier in the cast, Nintendo has been making a push towards more mobile displays, more free-to-play, or they said free-to-start design. And there was, of course, the big announcement that they're teaming up with a big, I think, Japanese or Chinese mobile game developer, DENA, D-E-N-A, something like that.
DENA, yeah.
And they're trying to bring the Nintendo properties to the mobile market. And I'm just wondering, Craig, in your opinion, do you think that a quality or premium purchase game like a Mario or a Zelda or something like that could work in the mobile space, considering the preconceptions of the consumers there?
Yeah, I think that it could absolutely work, because it kind of already has, at mm-hmm. least in the case of Mario. With a Super Mario game, remember that a lot of the early Nintendo stuff, and this is, again, my opinion, but a lot of the early Nintendo stuff was originated as an arcade game, and a lot of the design was in there to just make it friggin' crazy hard. There's a reason we still call it Nintendo hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's to eat quarters. And that worked. People liked it. Now, granted, it was new. I mean, we're talking, you know, Space Invaders was, you know, the 100 yen coin shortage when it came out. But it worked once. And it wouldn't necessarily be abusive to very clearly say, hey, you buy this, you get X lives, here you go.
Mm-hmm.
If it's, hey, you know, try it out. Oh, you're out of lives, pay to have any more, or wait 6 days to get more. That ends up feeling a little rough. That can veer toward the abusive, but I don't think it has to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you go into something like a model where, hey, you get the core game, you get the first four worlds, and you get an ending at the end of that. And if you want to play chapter two with four more worlds and a complete ending mm-hmm. at the end of that, give us a dollar and a half, and there you go.
And that's a really good point, that perception of where the pricing is, or where the free turns into the premium. I think if you really do need to spell that out. And as you said, there's a big difference between a game saying, oh, you ran out of lives, wait a week or give us $5, versus, hey, you beat world one, you want world two, you know, throw us $3-$4 and you unlock this new world with all these new challenges.
Yeah, and the difference there being, it's like, okay, well, wait, I played a little and now they want money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if I chip in this time, do I get world two and I have to pay for world three? Mm-hmm. When does it stop? Like, how often do I have to pay in order to keep going? How much am I committing to?
Mm-hmm.
Versus like, hey, pay us this flat rate. Here's what you get. The end.
Yeah. And if you enjoy more, here's, you know, option two, option three, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. And again, that's my preferred model, where everybody knows what they're getting and there's not a ton of question about that. But again, that is closer to the more traditional model of monetization just for console and PC games. Like, here's what you get. Go for mm-hmm. it. You want more? Here's what here's what it costs.
Yeah. Or I think the term you use are the patronage. Of...
Almost. Yeah. Honestly. Well, okay. So that's more for like a, hey, it's all free. Mm-hmm. There are some cosmetic, it's not pay to win. Pay to win is the devil, and I'll go on record for that. But for the patronage thing, that's more like, it's all free. There's cosmetic stuff. Do you want to look super cool? Do you want the cool scarf? Do you want the glowing mm-hmm. sword? It doesn't do any more damage, but all right. And then you can be like, all right, yeah, you know what? That was worth it. Let me chip in. This is essentially like, you made good art, or you showed me a good time.
Yeah.
Please do more of it.
It's almost like a tip, in a sense. You're tipping the designer, saying, hey, I enjoyed your game for the last 5 hours. Let me throw you $2-$3 and I'll get this cool scarf, or I'll get this, you know, little sparkly effect on my character.
Yeah, although I almost but I almost hesitate to say tip because the language implies a small amount. For me, I mean, for me, my valuation limit is like, okay, look, would I have gotten as much enjoyment from my money if I'd gone to see a movie that I liked? And if I basically is like, well, all right, I put in, you know, 2 hours for it, or I put in 10 hours, like, would I have paid $6 an hour to do this? Like, all right, cool. It's at least as good as a movie that I liked. Like, that's my sort of was it good enough bar. But that opportunity to sort of be like, yeah, that was good stuff. Like, I'm remembering, again, my time with Warframe. I put in like $100-$150 into that game. And I mean, if somebody had said like, hey, that's how much this game costs, do you want to play it? I would have been like, hell no, because it's unproven. So it's like, I think it's a completely different valuation. It's a completely different value judgment, or valuation judgment, really, after the fact, when it's like, all right, now that you have experienced this, what would you say it was worth to you? It also helps that you're not like compelled to pay it. But
yeah. Now, do you see developers who go that free-to-play route almost as designing like full-length demos, in a sense, that they're trying to gauge the market on whether or not people will enjoy this, and then, you know, you enjoy this quote-unquote free part, and now here's the real game, or here's the extended value for $2 to $3 a pop, or something like that?
The pay-to-play demo is, I think that that's a sort of self-defeating, it's a self-defeating mentality. When you're working on a demo, for a long time when I was working on stuff, I would write down my ideas. I had this big old idea file, and I would be like, all right, well, here's some cool stuff, but I don't want to like use up all my good stuff all at once. So I should like dole out my really best ideas a little at a time, because who knows, I may not have any more. That's bullshit. I have long since switched to use your best ideas immediately. And all my stuff has gotten better because of that. Just immediately use your best ideas. You will have more. You had those in the first place. And so when you approach, I believe when you approach development of a game with the idea that like, hey, here's the demo, here's a little taste, you're selling yourself short, and you are selling the experience short, and you're sort of doing the user, doing the player a disservice. If you're clever enough to come up with a game idea in the first place, and you're clever enough to populate it with cool moments and cool experiences and cool gameplay, you will probably be able to keep doing that. And setting your developers up with the idea that, hey, this is just the demo, we'll put the cool shit later, cool stuff later, if you want to edit that, sorry, is you're hobbling yourself. It doesn't have to be that way. There will always be more cool stuff, you know, day after day, world without end. It'll be there. So why limit yourself? Why cut your users off, you know?
All right. Yeah, definitely great points, Craig. And this cast has just flown right by. I'm surprised how quickly we've gone through an hour of talking.
That really zipped by.
That's always the best types of podcasts. When we have those ones like, oh, we're only going to talk for 45 minutes. And then it's like 2 hours later, like, what the hell? We're not done yet. What's going on? But to wrap up this discussion, I know we could, we could sit here for another hour, only feel like maybe 30 minutes. But to wrap up this discussion, at least for tonight, I have just two general questions left for you, Craig. The first one, I guess sort of wrapping up this discussion of the mobile market in terms of developers trying to elevate it with more complicated design or reaching the core and hardcore market, hardcore audience. In your opinion, what do you think about developers trying to release premium games? I'm talking someone trying to release a $15, $20 mobile game. Now, in the past, we've seen that kind of crash and burn. Square Enix was attempting that with their Final Fantasy titles. I think they released like The World Ends With You on there. And they were trying to go for like $15, $20, and no one was taking it. But as developers are trying to expand their audience and expand their to the core and hardcore, do you think we will see developers try to up the pricing and maybe try to compete with like indie development with like $10 to $20 games?
Yeah, I actually think that we are going to see that, but I don't know if it's the best idea right now. We got to sort of figure out how to do it in a smarter way. Some of them may have been good, but if I think back, like, what have I heard about Square Enix's mobile Final Fantasy ports, the memories that I have are like, hey, nobody's been sort of super thrilled with them. They may have been good. I don't know. Have you heard any glowing reviews about that kind of stuff?
No, not really.
All right, fair enough. And again, it might be, but I haven't heard of it. And again, with The World Ends With You, that's a present. I believe that that is a presentation issue. Again, I'm a designer. I'm not doing marketing any more than, you know, the design part requires. It's not what really lights my fire, but that's okay. But it would seem to me that with Final Fantasy and The World Ends With You, that these games were ports, and not that the port quality was bad, but the idea was that people who were going to buy these games, I want to say a lot of them probably already played them, or at least had played games similar to them. And when, you know, with The World Ends With You, when you've got it on, it was DS, right?
3DS. No, wait. It was 3. No, it was the regular DS. I remember.
Okay. Yeah. When it's on DS, like, that's the platform it was designed for. Mm-hmm. Like, the presentation is mapped to the platform. And when you're going over to, I think part of it is just developer inexperience with doing core games on mobile. And that will, that will change over time. Mm-hmm. Developers will become more experienced. I mean, you look at any console generation and you see, compare the games that came out in release week versus the games that came out a month before the next console was released. Mm-hmm. And it's a world of difference.
Yeah.
More of a world of difference with the older consoles because the power just goes up and up. But the point is there. We'll figure it out. I think, so that's the presentation aspect of it. I think we're going to see the higher end stuff come out anyway because it's really, really hard for an industry in aggregate to learn from the mistakes of the previous generation in the industry. And when I say that, I mean the bloating of AAA budgets, basically, for their games. So, you know, where it's X million dollars to work on this game. You know, it's a $60 game. We have to sell X million copies in order to even break even, let alone call it a rousing success. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's very straightforward to throw more money, throw more production value at a game that may not necessarily increase the quality or even the profitability of the game at a linear scale. And so I think that hopefully we learn from it, and hopefully more attention is paid to the quality rather than the production value of the game. But we're going to see it. I mean, I believe we will see the prices of mainstream game releases start to go up. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll suffer through it for a while, and who knows, maybe we won't learn our lesson. Maybe it'll be another boiling frog thing, and it'll be like, oh yeah, I got the new game on the iPhone 13 or whatever, and it was only $25, and nobody bats an eye. Mm. An extreme example, but I'm hoping that we learn our lesson that the tremendous production values of the AAA industry are ultimately not completely supportable while still expecting to sell reasonable number of copies. Which is very convenient for me because I am a designer and I get to advocate for, like, hey guys, we should iterate on, make sure the game is more fun before we go live with it. So it's very self-serving, and I will go right out and say that. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that it's a problem to advocate for making games that are more fun than they might otherwise be. I feel pretty good saying that.
Okay. Now, another part of that, I think, is that if developers do attempt to go up into the 10, 20 plus area for the mobile market, I do think, as you said, there's definitely going to be a learning curve, and I think there's definitely going to have to be a shift in the model, because I think if your game is free to play or 99 cents, in-app purchases are treated a lot more fairly. But if someone's spending $20, $30 on a game, I don't know how well they're going to really take to, oh, you bought this game for $20, but now there's little $4 or $5 of in-app purchases here and there.
If the in-app purchases climb up where, like, the lowest one is $5, people are going to start getting pissed off. Mm-hmm. But I'm pretty sure that if the boiling frog scenario comes true, will, in that world, we'll see $20 games that still have in-app purchases for 99 cents, $1, $2, like that kind of thing. Mm. And I think that that would just come with that future. But the thing is, these aren't mutually exclusive scenarios.
Yeah.
There is no reason why some games can exist at the 99 cent market, or the 99 cent point, or the free point, and the 10, the 15, the $20. Yeah. And that's going to be, again, linked with the development of the audience as they mature and say, like, okay, now we've seen enough of that kind of game. you really have to offer us something new and compelling for us to value it at that point that you're asking for it.
Yeah.
So it's going to evolve as we go forward.
All right. Here is my last question regarding mobile and monetization for tonight. And I'm sure this is going to be an interesting one to end on. Especially, this is probably going to be our debate-causing question right here. So I hope you're ready for it.
you keep asking my designer self questions about monetization, so I'll struggle along, but hit me. What do you got?
All right. This final question is regarding, in your opinion, the stability of the mobile and casual game market. When I've spoken to previous developers, especially my conversation with Thorsten Rosler a few months ago, I brought up the topic that a lot of people feel that there's some aspect of the game industry that is heading for another potential crash. And one area that I've spoken to a lot of the core gamer friends and core designers, there's definitely this feeling that right now the current target is going to be mobile game development. That's the section that may be crashing in the next 3 to 5 years in terms of the game industry. So, considering your place at Pocket Gems and what you've been looking at in terms of mobile game development, what do you think about that statement? Do you think the mobile market could be heading for a crash, or do you think that it will become stable or that it is even just fine right now?
So when you talk about a video game crash, you reference back to the Atari days when there was the great video game crash of the 80s. I think it was the 80s. Anyway, it was either 80s or early 90s. Anyway, yeah, the video game crash. Mm-hmm. And as far as I understand, the reason why that occurred was because there was a glut of low-quality games. Now, I can see the comparison. We're like, hey, there's a million new games out on the App Store today, and they're all terrible, and they're all 99 cents, and fine. I think the difference here is that, again, it's that lack of mutual exclusivity. Mm-hmm. That the reason the game industry crashed in the first time was because there were no alternatives. That all the stuff coming out, like aside from the occasional diamond where you got a new Nintendo game or anything like that and the quality was there. Mm-hmm. And they were kind of flying by the seat of their pants too at that point. But that's all right. They had the magic sauce. For all the crappy games, it was so hard to dig out the good stuff from the pile, and there wasn't that big a pile to begin with. Mm-hmm. Compare that with now, where we've got two things. One, there is no exclusivity for like all the games are terrible or, you know, they're all good. No, there are, as there tend to be, a giant pile of mediocre games, some real stinkers, but there still exists perfectly good games. Now, the difference here is that it is much easier to find them now. Even though that there's orders of magnitude more of them, we are more communicative with each other. It is easier to search for this stuff. It's easier to find people talking like, hey, what's a good game? You've got all kinds of social media and forums and the infinite subreddits and wikis and all this stuff. It's much easier to find the information you want, whereas previously, oh, you want to learn about video games? Okay, go check the two pages in the back of Sears for what's coming out.
Yeah.
So is there going to be a crash? I don't buy it. I think that the situation isn't that dire. I think that it's easier to surface high quality stuff, and being able to surface high quality stuff is what's going to keep the industry as a whole floating. And I think that there is a lot more resiliency in the industry now than there was before, because before it was, oh, okay, you got a console, great, it's done. Or you were one of those weird dudes with a hobby computer. But again, things are different now.
Yeah.
You've got PC gaming, you've got all the various flavors of console gaming, you've even got the multiple tiers of console gaming with one side leaning more toward the hardcore players and one side leaning less toward the hardcore players. You've got mobile games, you've got casual mobile games, you've got the more hardcore mobile games, you've got free-to-play. There are you have diversified your bonds. If the bottom drops out of one area, it doesn't mean the whole industry crashes out. And even if you're still talking about just mobile games, mobile, I believe, will diversify or has already diversified enough that if the audience as a whole decide, you know what, we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore about mechanic X or monetization effort X, it's not going to kill everything. That's chicken littling. It's needless doomsaying.
Okay. And I hate to do this, but as you were talking, I remember one final mobile-related question. I should have asked this earlier in the cast when we were talking.
No, it's okay. I like talking to you. It's all right.
Nice. Thank you. But one other part that I'm really curious about, and this is something that I ask a lot of the developers who I have on, who are mobile developers who specialize in the mobile game market, is what do you think about the iOS store? Because I've spoken to several developers who say that there are issues with it in terms of discoverability and getting your game out there. So I'm just wondering, Craig, with your at your time at Pocket Gems and working on these mobile games, how are you finding the iOS store as being able to be a great platform to deliver games to consumers?
I consider it a blessing and a privilege of my station that it is not something I need to worry about in my day-to-day job. There's a little bit of sorcery that goes into sort of playing the mini game that is the getting your game in the App Store. Having never had to lead that charge, I can't comment on it in any huge amount of depth. But again, while it is easier to surface new content just in terms of like doing your search, a lot of people who are going to be playing your more casual games are not adept at navigating those channels. They may not know like, I can Google this and I can go find this sub forum or I can go find this whatever. It's easy to lay the blame on fast follows and clones. I mean, take a look at Flappy Bird and how, you know, the day of Flappy Bird, there were, 100 clones of it. And they were clones. Like, nobody's making any bones about that. They're the same damn game. But would it be easier to sort of dance that dance if the App Store's search algorithms were tweaked a little bit? Maybe, probably. But this is what happens when someone's running the only game in town. So if anything, I could only hope that we see more meaningful diversification of the market in terms of where you can go to get your games. I don't have an iOS device in terms of my own personal stuff. I run an Android. I'm pretty happy with the Android, with the Google Play Store, like that kind of stuff. And because I know that if I want to get something that's not in that walled garden, and again, these walled garden, that kind of stuff, these are sound bites that I've picked up as I've gone. Ultimately, the more places there are to put your games, the more different, the more diversified areas you can say, hey, I put this here and it's good, the better we're going to be. So I guess I'm kind of sad that the App Store is closed in the way it is. But I think that it would be disingenuous to lay that entirely at the feet of Apple in terms of why that is occasionally difficult to manage.
All right. Yep, and it's definitely interesting to see if we will have other iOS stores or other options for iOS game selling. We've seen over the indie market over the last few years a number of stores come on to challenge Steam. We have GOG, Green Man Gaming, there's still Gamersgate, I think, going on. And so it's definitely gone a lot easier to sell your game to these multiple fronts. Now,
The Humble Store is there too.
Yeah, I almost forgot that one. But obviously, Steam is still the 100-pound gorilla in the same way that the iOS store is still the one that's the most conscious in everyone's eyes. So it will be interesting to see if things will diversify over the next 5 years, because we are reaching that point where smartphones, especially the mobile market, is becoming almost as commonplace. It's something that everyone has compared to like 10 years ago, or maybe even a little less than that, when it was still, the new hot piece of technology, only meant for the super enthusiast crowd.
Yeah, although I would call attention to your timeline. I think 5 years is an eternity. We may not even be using smartphones at all in 5 years. I mean that seriously. Yeah. Like, 5 years in this industry is a career start to finish.
Yeah.
So I would expect to see something interesting in that regard in the next year or two, if even that long. I mean, every year is a new season, as it goes.
Yeah.
Like I said, more diversity in offerings is only benefits the user.
Yeah, definitely. And since we were already running long, I guess it can't hurt to ask you one other random question then.
All right, go for it.
What are your thoughts, or have you paid any attention to the Rift and augmented reality or the virtual reality trends that are going on? Because we've had numerous developers on over the last few years who've had vastly different opinions on VR and just, you know, where is it going in the next, even like 2-3 years from now?
Oh man, I want it to be the real deal so bad. I wanna see that. Mm-hmm. I think of myself as an artist, which is, again, very, very ivory tower thing for me to say. And it's cool that I have the luxury of doing that. Mm-hmm. But I want to see more cool stuff like that. I want to see more ways that neat things can be shown. I want to see more innovation like that. If VR is the thing, then awesome. I want to see that come in. And I don't want to see somebody have to pay $350 to mount a giant eyes set to their face to do it. I mean, that said, I'll end up doing it inevitably because, like, I want to try out the new stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But you're going to be hard-pressed to do that unless something or someone as large as, like, PlayStation says, hey, the new console, it's an Oculus Rift with a processor unit attached to it. Like, that's the level of commitment that I think is going to have to be made in order to make VR really, really, really the next big thing and not, like, wait, that thing that Facebook bought a while back and John Carmack is involved? What? Anyway.
Yeah.
If it's the next thing, awesome. Let's dive in. If it's not, it's still fun, but I can't wait to see what comes next.
Awesome. All right. I mean, again, I have like 10 more topics in my head that we could just rattle on for the next 2 to 3 hours.
You gotta let me come back later on. We can talk more about this.
Definitely. Okay. I know we were originally supposed to go for an hour, but it's always great catching up with old friends. And Craig, it has been a pleasure talking to you.
It has been a pleasure, yes.
We really could just sit here and talk about like 5-6 more topics and just spend the rest of this night talking. But I try to keep to at least somewhat of a schedule before we used to have like the 3-3.5 hour podcast. And then that just becomes an ordeal for everyone. And I got so many more podcasts scheduled for next week probably a few weeks for those of you listening to this right now.
You were mentioning that you had a lot of very interesting guests lined up, yes.
Yeah, I've got going to be talking to some developers, the guys from, by the time you hear this, I have already talked with developers from Flipfly Studios who did Race the Sun. We have some very interesting debate-related topics coming up. I don't want to spoil it here, or you'll already know about for those of you listening, but very interesting topics that we will be discussing in full with some upcoming podcasts. But yeah, Craig, it has been great talking to you. Yeah, we definitely need to catch up some more, and of course, hit me up if you want to get back into Payday 2, because that is my go-to game. We all have that one game we like to go back to. I have one friend who's obsessed with Team Fortress, another one with Dota. Mine is Payday 2.
I will do my best to not embarrass myself or dump body bags directly in front of guards.
Awesome. All right. With that said, Craig, like I said, we could sit here and talk for the next 2 hours, but for tonight and the end of this cast, my final question for you is, do you have any final thoughts on any topics we've talked about or anything you would like to say to fans of Pocket Gems or mobile games in general? Just, you know, anything. The floor is yours.
For fans of Pocket Gems, if you are listening, hello. It's my pleasure to do things for you. Go on our forums. Talk to us. Let us know. Please let us know what you like. A lot of the time we're like, oh, well, we think that we like this. It's so much easier when you just tell us. It really is, and we do care. We do care. If you're playing a game and you're trying to contact the developers and they're making your life difficult about it, play something else. There are so many games, there's so many developers where you can honestly have that kind of conversation with your users, with your players, that you can afford to find essentially that relationship with a developer who cares about you. So let us know what you think. We really, really do care.
Awesome. All right. So with that said, we're going to wrap up the cast here. Again, Craig, it has been just a treat having you on and catching up with you, and we definitely have to do this some more in the future.
Definitely.
So for those of you listening, we're going to wrap up the cast here. Thank you so much for tuning in. And as always, if you'd like to contribute to Game Wisdom, we have several options available. If you'd like to be a future podcast guest, either for a regular cast or one of our roundtables, you can send me an email under submissions wanted. And that's also if you'd like to contribute with a guest piece of the site on any topics relating to game design in the industry. All information and links can be found on that Submissions Wanted link on the front page. And to contribute to our Patreon campaign to secure some much-needed monthly funding for the site, you can find that under the Patreon banner on the front page. Or if you're browsing on Patreon.com, just search for Josh Beister or Game Wisdom, and I should pop up. And lastly, if you'd like to watch me play games live while talking about the design or just having fun in general, you can catch me on my Twitch channel under GW Beister, usually daily around 9 or 10 or so Eastern Standard Time, and that all gets loaded to our YouTube channel, which there will be links to over there. So, once again, thanks for tuning in, have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.